Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for, well, an intelligence briefing on what I call the war for the free world. Big changes in that war, here at home at least, in the course of yesterday's elections. The Republicans took control of the Senate. A majority they previously had in the House was increased, and extraordinary results at the level of various governors around the nation, which went from Democratic hands to Republican or saw Republicans reelected. Against, in some cases, long odds. To help make sense of what this means, both for the polity and for our policies, I am thrilled to have one of the most, I think, thoughtful of observers. She is nationally syndicated columnist and best-selling author Diana West. You can find her work at dianawest.net, and of course her superb books, Death of the Grown-Up, and American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. Diana, welcome back. Well, it was a long night for you, I'm sure, as for all of us. What do you make of what came of it?
Well, it was a very exciting outcome because it showed that the body politic was still alive. I take these sweeping changes as very, you know, very heartening news. I see them as a cry for help. A cry for help to Republicans to do something to stop the lawlessness, to stop the drift, to stop the socialization, to stop Obamacare, to stop amnesty. I mean, this really was a very decisive message to someone to do something. I mean, really, that's what I see this as more than anything else. It was an extreme rejection of the past 6 years.
And, you know, it was fascinating that in his seeming narcissism and hurt feelings about not being allowed to campaign for basically anybody, raise money, yes, but not go out and be seen on the hustings, Barack Obama did what Republicans could only have dreamed of him doing, which is to say, to personally place on the agenda, as he put it, that every one of his policies was going to be on the ballot, even though he were not. To that extent, Diana, that this really represented a repudiation by the American people of those policies, do you think that the Republicans are likely to respond to the cry for help, as you call it, and establish really a distinction and an alternative path for America?
Honestly, no. I don't think that they will deliver. I will certainly do my best in terms of writing to hold them to these promises that they've made and this hope that they have given the American people. But we have to be quite cynical about this. We've seen so often these chances thrown away, and I think one of the first very important moves will be when we see what kind of leadership the new Republican conference will elect. This is key. So time will tell. I answer your question honestly. It may not be the happy face, but I think we have to be realistic, and people need to stay on their case. Individual citizens need to stay on their individual representative cases.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. And it is most palpably obvious in the Senate, where the next go-around, the Republicans will not be doing what they were doing in this race. They will have many seats up for grabs, and I think there will be a very high likelihood that they will find themselves out on their ears, at least as a majority in the Senate, if they don't live up to the promises. So we'll look forward to helping you keep them honest and fulfilling, particularly when it comes to things like opposing President Obama's efforts to provide amnesty through executive action or other examples of lawlessness or his embrace of the Islamists or his, very, very dubious conduct with respect to Ebola, all things that I think were palpably of concern to voters that need, as you say, corrective action. Let me switch gears a little bit. One other place where we're going to be watching a lot of political ferment, I suspect, is with respect to Afghanistan. In your column, you've written about the need for accountability there. Talk a little bit about what you think is the degree of accountability that our government officials should be, you know, responsible for.
Well, we're looking at the pullout of American forces over the next months. We've already seen the Marines leaving Helmand Province. We've seen Army forces really packing it up as well just this week. This is a 13-year-long war of tremendous cost and sacrifice, tremendous amounts of money, billions and billions of dollars, and many men's lives, many of our fighting forces' lives and limbs and health and mental well-being, and their families, and America's reaction to all of this. And none of this has ever had any kind of reality check. None of this has ever had any kind of meaningful oversight. We lost based on a losing strategy that was blind to A, Islam, and B, what could be accomplished by an American force in the Islamic world in Afghanistan in terms of, quote, nation building. These policies were disasters that have not been examined, have not been publicly repudiated, and have not really even been acknowledged. So a call for accountability is a call to have hearings on what went wrong in Afghanistan. These are the same policy.
As you've pointed out in your writings, particularly at your columns, which people, again, can find at dianawest.net, a central piece of the problem in both countries was this so-called counterinsurgency strategy or COIN strategy, and sort of its foundation on not just sand, but quicksand, really, that we could ignore the inherent nature of Sharia specifically and its hostility towards us as we try to build nations in both places. Diana, talk about the specific case of a Sergeant Miller as kind of a paradigm for that COIN strategy run amok.
Well, Sergeant Derek Miller is currently serving a sentence of life without possibility of parole at Leavenworth Prison. He has no possibility of parole for 10 years. He's exhausted his legal appeals, and essentially he was convicted of premeditated murder on the battlefield in the perimeter of his base, which was surrounded by four hostile villages, and an Afghan penetrated the perimeter. Very long story short, Sergeant Miller killed this Afghan and was convicted of premeditated murder. It is one of the most amazing travesties of justice out of score, you know, just a lot of this terrible, terrible system of punishing military personnel as if they are functioning in an American city and not a kinetic battlefield everywhere they go. And we've seen this time and time again. And his case is particularly egregious now that we look at the seeming emptying of Guantanamo Bay, while not giving any notion, any merciful dispensation of clemency to men like Sergeant Miller, and there are others who continue to be tormented by the military justice system, losing their lives that they did come home with from the battlefield, but now they are rotting in prison for these same failed COIN policies. I mean, they are the prisoners of COIN. They are the actual people who have to pay for this policy, and it's absolutely shameful.
It is, and it will prove, I'm afraid, extraordinarily counterproductive, Diana West, because as you've taught me, and I think many of us, the practical effect of this kind of bizarre policy on our enemies. On the one hand, they can only perceive our conduct of the wars as evidence of our unwillingness to use our power, which they read as weakness. And our mistreatment of our own people for simply defending themselves is further evidence of submission, it seems, to their program. All of these are reasons for you to be, very much heard in your appeal for accountability on the one hand and course corrections on the other. I pray this new Republican majority in the House and Senate will heed these appeals and take the necessary steps to get us back on a sensible footing and contend with an adversary determined to destroy us. Diana West, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you for this immediate reaction to the events of yesterday. We'll look forward to talking with you next week about them and more. In the meantime, stay well. Thank you so much for all you do. Next up, we'll talk with Jim Hansen. We'll get his boots-on-the-ground perspective on all of this and what it might mean specifically, this change of government for national security. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
Hi, I'm Tim McGraw. The men and women of the Air Force Reserve play a vital role in protecting us at home and abroad. They are your neighbors, whose dedication to our country and commitment to their communities call them to serve. Dedication, commitment, and service. It happens every day at home and around the world. They're your neighbors, making a difference.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
It's important to plan ahead for emergencies, like the storm. When it kicked in, we had a plan.
Separated.
We were able to get in touch with each other in no time.
We had no idea how to find each other.
The whole experience was fine.
Was the most frightening 10 hours of my life.
If there's one piece of advice I'd offer other moms out there, it's to stay calm and keep to the plan.
Message.
Some parents plan ahead. Some don't. Make sure you know where to find your family in an emergency. Start your plan at ready.gov. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
I lost my arm.
I lost my legs.
But you can't see what I lost. Over 625,000 vets are suffering from traumatic brain injury
and post-traumatic stress. They're the wounds you can't see.
But with your help, we can expose the invisible wounds of war.
And get these veterans the help they desperately need.
100% of your donation goes toward building treatment centers. Help heal the invisible wounds of war. Donate at makeitvisible.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by the man who brings the boots on the ground perspective to our fulminations here at Secure Freedom Radio. A man I'm very pleased to say is now a colleague of ours at the Center for Security Policy's Secure Freedom Roku channel, where he produces Free Fire Zone. And we'll talk in a moment about his latest production, a commentary that you can find on your Roku set. Jim Henson is a former Special Forces operator in the United States Army. He has since, separating from the military, gone on to a number of other things, including, very importantly, helping to co-found the Warrior Legacy Foundation. He blogs at black5.net and is always a welcome guest here. Jim, good to have you with us.
Happy day, Frank.
Happy day indeed. Well, let's talk a little bit about what you make of the election outcomes as they bear on possible changes in course for national security. Is that too much to hope for or in the offing, do you think?
Given that the Republicans now own Congress, I think if anything, it's going to put a brake on what Obama can do. But I don't know that national security was really the issue this election was running on. You know, it seemed to be the economy and a bunch of other things. However, you know, the Senate does have an important role in treaties and some other things. Obama's got some bad ideas about what he wants to do with Iran and, you know, other nuclear free zone type ideas. So I'm hoping at least that it puts some sort of a slowdown on some of the bad ideas he's had and really gives the country a chance to take a deep breath and say maybe the path we've been on was not the right one, because America sure seems to think that.
Well, that's certainly true at the macro level, and I think it actually was operating with respect to at least some things that bear on national security, Jim. I think that the misgivings about the president's handling of these various wars and the degree to which we're now witnessing the problem, if anything, intensifying. You mentioned Iran on the one hand, there's the Islamic State on the other, the Muslim Brotherhood and so on. But not least, the president's attitude towards illegal aliens being given an amnesty, which will, with our insecure borders, only ensure that more come here in short order, with profound implications, I think, for both our economy, for sure, and our, you know, people's employment opportunities, but also for our security. So I think that was a backdrop. It may not have been the decisive factor in all of these races, but it certainly was part of the environment. Jim Henson is our guest. We're talking about the repercussions of this recently completed 2014 midterm election for national security. And one place that seems there's an urgent need for course correction, Jim Henson, is this practice of how we treat our own military as opposed to how we treat our enemies. Talk a little bit about the tale of two sergeants that's the subject of your new commentary at the Free Fire Zone on the Secure Freedom Roku channel.
Well, Frank, I was struck when the Marine Sergeant Andrew Camerisi finally was free. He spent over 200 days in a Mexican jail for getting caught by the bad traffic direction signaling and accidentally crossing the border with guns that were legal in the U.S. And I just never understood why our president did nothing to help this man get free. The entire administration, the entire power of the U.S. government was dormant as he lay rotting in the jail. You know, he's got PTSD, he's got a bunch of the problems, and we did nothing for him. And what struck me was there was another sergeant, Bo Bergdahl, who the president put the entire weight of the U.S. government behind getting his freedom. Now, that's a good thing, okay? He is a U.S. soldier. We do leave no man behind. However, that doesn't mean you make any deal possible to bring him home. And one of the things I point out in the show is that we not only freed five dangerous Taliban terrorists and returned them to the fight against us, we paid a ransom by proxy, allowing the Qataris to give money. Almost $10 million, somewhere in the $5 to $10 million range, was paid to the Haqqani network who was holding Sergeant Bergdahl. So I don't understand the difference between that and how, you know, somehow the president seemed to think that it was worth making a horrible deal for Bergdahl and letting Sergeant Tamariki rot in Mexican prison.
It does seem as though it's a bizarre policy disconnect. Jim, it may get more bizarre if, as I understand it, the administration is about to whitewash the Bergdahl piece of this story by, you know, sort of essentially trying to, well, conceal, I guess, the nature of his desertion. Are you picking up stories to that effect? And what might the implications be, were they to do that, for morale and the relations between the administration and the military?
Oh, absolutely, Frank. And that's part of the reason that I wanted that piece to come out now, is let's get it back in the news, let's get it back in the public's mind. Because they were properly outraged that a likely deserter, now he's still going to get a trial, hopefully. You know, that's the big fear, is that they do not, that they somehow give him non-judicial punishment and don't give him an actual court-martial. But he needs to be in front of a court-martial. He needs to be tried by a jury of his peers. And if what seems likely from the reports my friends have told me about, they need to send him to prison for desertion. And if that doesn't happen, there will be outrage, there will be issues with morale, all the things you mentioned. And we need to do what we can to make sure that doesn't happen.
Well, I appreciate so much you doing what you can with your extraordinary skill now at the Secure Freedom Roku channel, Jim Hansen. Let me turn to another subject that I suspect is very much in your wheelhouse, Jim. As a former special operator, you're familiar with the restrictions under which those who serve in those elite forces have to submit to in terms of restrictions on their activities, or disclosure of their activities, at least, let's say. There is a report that Fox News has in the can, I guess, an interview with the Navy SEAL who pulled the trigger and killed Osama bin Laden, that it is going to run shortly. Jim, first of all, is that something that you think is permissible for the operator in question? And secondly, advisable?
No, it's not, Frank. And that's not even a, there's not a question about it. It's absolutely wrong. He signed a non-disclosure agreement about classified operations saying he would never do this. And it's necessary that that happens for a number of reasons. Not just national security, not just the safety of the families of these units and other people by revealing the identities of the people conducting these operations, but do we really want a bunch of guys who are out on the next mission to kill the next high-value target all jostling to be the one who pulls the trigger so they can get the movie deal, you know, so they can be the one who gets the book deal, gets to be on Fox News? It's wrong. That's the quiet professionals. That is a long-standing and necessary tradition, and I don't understand when it went away, and I think the military needs to put its foot down and stop it now before everybody wants to be a TV star, not an operator.
Jim, very quickly, one other consideration is this is taking place at the same time as the Defense Department is putting out, as I understand it, three different warnings for military personnel and their families that they may be at risk of attack from the Islamic State or perhaps other jihadists influenced by them. This seems to be a further reason why it would be undesirable, to say the least, and impermissible for this kind of disclosure to be made. Presumably the guy understands the risks in doing it, but I think for all the reasons you've mentioned, it is something that should be very aggressively discouraged. Jim, I think we have to leave it at that for the moment. I appreciate, as always, your time with us here at Secure Freedom Radio and the great contribution you're making to the efforts of the Center for Security Policy, now as a senior fellow working with us on the Free Fire Zone programs of the Secure Freedom Roku channel. Check it out, folks. Jim, we'll talk with you again soon. Thanks so much for joining us. Next up, Elim Poblet joins us. We'll get her take as an experienced congressional staff hand on the elections and whether there's a reset coming for U.S. foreign policy. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Obama took what he called a shellacking in the 2010 midterms. What happened to his Democrats in the 2014 midterm elections was an absolute hammering. In entrusting the Senate to Republicans, increasing the GOP majority in the House, and giving Republican candidates key governorships, voters have repudiated, in the president's words, his policies, every single one of them. Unfortunately, my bet is that Mr. Obama will not adjust course in the wake of this defeat. He will instead double down, particularly on issues that were most resoundingly rejected: Obamacare and amnesty for illegal aliens. If that happens, the next 2 years are going to be difficult for the country, but at least it will be absolutely clear who is responsible for the policies the public opposes and who's on their side. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Navigating this world when you are undereducated can be difficult. I'm Dr. Ben Carson, and I know this for a fact. When I was growing up, my family lived in dire poverty, and because of my poor learning skills, my classmates called me dummy. My life began to turn around when my mother encouraged me to read. I went from the bottom of my class to graduating from Yale University and becoming the youngest director of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. I know how important it is to nurture a child's dream.
When I grow up, I want to become a scientist.
I want to be a doctor, just like Ben Carson.
I hope to become an engineer.
I want to be a teacher or maybe a broadcaster.
The Carson Scholars Fund is impacting schools across the nation by encouraging children to read, write, and excel at math and science so they can realize their dreams. We need your help. To learn more about the Carson Scholars Fund and to donate, visit our website at carsonscholars.org.
After all, the person who has the most to do with your success is you.
America's security and your way of life depend on having a Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard that are the best in the world. Without these seagoing patriots and the merchant marine that keep our shelves stocked with the products we need, the United States could not be the force for peace and prosperity in the world. The Navy League of the United States salutes the brave men and women, past and present, of the Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, and U.S. Flag Merchant Marine for answering the call to service.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them.
When you make fun of them.
When you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent talk.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by yet another expert with considerable experience in matters involving the Congress, in part to take stock on yesterday's extraordinary outcomes of the elections as they bear on both what's the likely future direction of the Senate and the House of Representatives. She is Dr. Elim Poblet. She served for two decades on the staff of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs, including as its chief of staff and staff director. She held a number of other capacities and positions in the Congress. She is one of the preeminent experts on congressional oversight of foreign affairs, and it's always a pleasure to have her with us. Welcome back, Evelyn.
Thanks, Frank. It's definitely a good day. A good day for freedom and a good day for conservative principles.
Well, and I really want to talk with you a bit about the application of those principles, if Congress properly understands its mandate. In previous conversations with some of our other guests, there's been some mulling as to whether or not there will, in fact, be a sort of new conservative, well, majority and direction coming out of the Congress as it relates to foreign affairs. What do you think?
I think there will be. There won't be the dramatic shift that was palpable in the 94 elections when we had the contract with America and we had these very clear parameters. But despite what the pundits have said, that foreign policy played a minimal role and that the significant concerns of the American people were the economy, it stems also from the economy and from foreign policy. There is that linkage. And what do I mean by that? Well, there was a general concern throughout the nation about the management of this administration. There was a general concern about the security, that sense of what are we going to leave behind for the next generations? And it transcended beyond just the very narrow domestic economic concerns, beyond unemployment. It was the general sense of security and that general sense of what America stands for. And what does that mean going forward for the Congress, especially in the Senate? They realize that they have only 2 years, and actually perhaps even less, a year and a half, to send a statement to the American people going into a presidential election that they made the right decision in shifting that power balance and in the need to have the legislative branch exert itself and do what it is constitutionally mandated to do.
Look, I can completely agree with your analysis of this. Let's talk about some specifics. Talk a bit about Iran. I know you've been very exercised, as we should be, about Iran's presence in our hemisphere. There's also this deal that the president seems to be intent on cutting, no matter how bad it is, with respect to Iran's nuclear weapons program. Give us a sense of what you think the Congress might and should do with respect to both of those aspects of the Iran policy brief.
Well, I've already heard from a number of sources in both the House and the Senate that the fact the Republicans gained control of both chambers in the Congress on the day that marked the anniversary of the embassy takeover and the taking of our hostages by the Iranian radicals was not by coincidence. And they view it as a galvanizing force. And there's already rumors about using the National Defense Authorization Act to tighten some of the language that was in the House passed bill, language relating to the requirements that must be met before the administration can sign off on any sort of deal with the Iranians. There's also discussions about putting prohibitions on the use of funds for any further negotiations, whether through the P5+1 or at the UN or through the IAEA, towards a nuclear deal that accepts any form of uranium, any form of enriched uranium, that accepts maintaining the rest of Iran's nuclear infrastructure. And it clearly states you must dismantle. We're not talking about temporary suspensions. You must dismantle all this program. So there's already conversations about that. And with Iran and the hemisphere, the GAO report, in one sense, I view it as a missed opportunity because it wasn't an independent report on the threat. But it's very valuable because it shows the frustration, the fact that it clearly noted that the Southern Command, the military command, as you all know, responsible for the Americas, was one of the dissenting voices in the report that the State Department submitted last year. It gives those who are concerned about Iranian activities in the hemisphere that tool, that hook that they need. And there's language in the defense authorization bill having to do with providing SOUTHCOM the assets and the resources and the investment that they need to address the transnational threats, to address border security from the southern perspective, and to address Iranian activities in the hemisphere. So there's already talk about this.
Ilham Prohlblut is our guest, formerly was a senior member of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs, including its staff director for a time, working very closely with its then chairman, Ileana Rosleitanen. And I know she has been very engaged on these issues, and you've underscored the Government Accountability Office study that really found the administration very derelict in administering, you know, sort of any kind of countervailing force against what the Iranians are up to. And you've underscored the importance of the defense authorization bill. I hope we get one. Its future status is a little unclear in the lame duck. Let me turn quickly. We're going to run out of time long before we run out of topics to discuss with you, Lem. One of the very, very troubling pieces of the administration's stewardship of foreign policy at the moment is another that I know you're very concerned about and very experienced in, and that's the U.S.-Israel relationship. Talk about what the new Congress might do to reset that policy practice at the moment.
Well, for starters, you'll see the movement of legislation that has been lagging because the administration has been blocking it. And what you'll see is an increase provision in certain military equipment and certain systems that Israel needs to fully prepare against a potential Iranian attack, and not just a potential nuclear-related attack, but any sort of asymmetrical attack. What you'll also see is a full support of Israel at the United Nations. There'll be that countervailing force, to use your Reagan term, and boy, do we miss him. There'll be that countervailing force to the administration when it comes to the funding for the Palestinian Authority. There'll be that countervailing force for Palestinian efforts at the UN Security Council with respect to the Israeli settlements, because there will always be that threat from elements in the House and the Senate about funding U.S. Contributions or withdrawing the funding of U.S. Assessed contributions to the United Nations across the board, unless there is a sustained effort in support of Israel and to repel Palestinian efforts at all multilateral forum in addition to just the bilateral.
Ilem, I'm afraid we are out of time. I just want to make note of the fact that we have the spectacle as an example of this miscarriage of U.S. policy under the Obama administration towards Israel, of it having its representative tell the Supreme Court that Israel's relationship to Jerusalem is comparable to Russia's relationship to Crimea. This is really, it's scandalous, and I hope will be repudiated by the new Congress. Ilem, we have to leave it at that. I want to salute your piece at most recently I've seen at thenationalinterest.org on this business with Iran, and the point that you make of citing Machiavelli, that addressing these identified problems later when they've metastasized is always worse than sooner. Your counsel on these matters is greatly appreciated, as is your past service. Keep it up. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, we will be speaking with Dr. Peter Pham about developments in Africa, what we might learn from the West Africans on how to deal with Ebola, and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today,
all right, let's go,
or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand. For each other, for our nation, for us all, the few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense.
We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by one of our duty experts on the continent of Africa. He is Dr. J. Peter Pham. He is the director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, a prodigious contributor to our thinking about and understanding of what is happening in Africa, our interests there, and what we need to do to advance them. His latest book is Somalia, Fixing Africa's Most Failed State. Peter Pham, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Frank, it's always a pleasure.
I'd like to start, Peter, your reading on how we're doing in countering the threat posed by this Ebola virus, which has been afflicting several countries of West Africa. There seems to have been some progress made there. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, and what lessons we might be well advised to learn here about it.
In Africa, the current Ebola epidemic, it has hit five African countries, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea, and then also made appearances in Senegal and Nigeria. The most recent update is that it appears that at least for the moment, the increase in the rate of infection in the three hardest hit countries, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, has diminished slightly. They're still well in the danger zone. It's still the hot zone of the disease. But the very good news is 2 weeks ago, the World Health Organization declared two countries, Senegal on the west coast of Africa, of course, Nigeria, Africa's most populous country, both to be disease-free, which means that they've gone 42 days, two 21-day cycles, which is the infection period of the disease, two 21-day cycles without any new cases. So essentially, they've eradicated Ebola, and I think they're very critical lessons that can be learned by the fact that two African countries, neither of which has any of the health infrastructure, the capabilities of a developed country like the United States, have managed to actually lick the disease.
And Peter, based on your close study of this, how have they done that? And what, again, might be the lessons or takeaways for us?
Well, let's start with Senegal, which is a smaller country. In Senegal, a student, a young man, traveling from neighboring Guinea, which is in a hot zone, brought the disease to Senegal over the summer. He crossed the border, developed a fever, checked into a hospital. They quickly diagnosed it. Senegalese authorities then immediately sealed their border with Guinea, a 200-mile border. They sealed it shut. They cut off all air and sea links to the affected countries. The point being that they had one disease patient, they have to deal with him, that they weren't going to allow any more in. Although they did keep the airport open for flights inward carrying aid from Dakar into the country, a humanitarian corridor, which is currently being staffed as a logistics center by about 100 U.S. military personnel. So the aid could flow in on carefully controlled, specialized flights, but no people were coming in. And as a result, Senegal also tracked down 74 people whom the young man with the virus had been in contact with, put all those people under close monitoring, sent government officials twice a day with medical personnel to take their temperature, monitor them for symptoms. And so at the end of the period, no one else got sick, and the young man actually, very fortunately, was cured. And the other interesting thing was they didn't make a spectacle out of the young man or the 74 people. Names weren't released. They quickly followed through on people they had contacted with, but it kept it anonymous and provided people with the medical, humanitarian, food, and even money to keep them going while they were under quarantine so that they wouldn't feel isolated or be left to their own devices, and it incentivized them to get involved. So Senegal licked it. Nigeria was an entirely different case, Frank. Nigeria didn't have the disease, but a Liberian official, again from the hot zone, flew into their country on a flight and literally collapsed in the arrivals hall at the airport in Lagos of his fever and rushed away to a hospital. That could have been a disaster because Lagos is one of the most heavily populated cities anywhere on the planet, and certainly in Africa, more than 20 million people, more than actually the population of the three countries in the hot zone put together. It could have been terrible. But the Nigerians actually, surprisingly almost, for those of us who watch Nigeria, they put their political differences between the federal government and the state government in Lagos, which is in opposition hands, put their differences aside. Within days, they stood up an emergency crisis response center, which was very effective. Let me give you an idea of the scale of what they did. They not only identified the man, but working with airlines, travel agencies, and hospitals, identified 900 people whom the man had either been in contact with or who were in contact with people he had been in contact with. And then they quickly put those under close observation and prepared quarantine centers for anyone that showed symptoms. Anyone who showed symptoms, fevers, was immediately put in, which is unlike what we saw in New York. They also did, and this is amazing, they visited 26,000 homes in a matter of days. So basically vectoring out from the one index patient, the guy who arrived, 26,000 homes, interviewed 18,500 people who had any contact with anyone who had any contact with, and so on back to that, so that they quickly pointed out who could have been possibly infected.
Let me turn to another topic. Burkina Faso is a country I'm sure most Americans have never heard of. It is now racked by some serious disturbances and an uncertain future. Talk a bit about what's at stake there and whether it should matter to us.
Burkina Faso has long been a pivotal state in the critical Sahel region, that band of where the desert meets the savanna, where North Africa meets sub-Saharan Africa, an area that's seen increasing militancy, al-Qaeda-linked militants, still active after the French intervention in northern Mali, Niger, close U.S. allies suffering from the fact that it shares a border with Libya, which is in disintegration mode, Nigeria, where Boko Haram is increasingly virulent and really becoming an insurgency. So Burkina Faso was the fulcrum that kind of kept the balance. It hosts the French anti-terrorism force that the French recently stood up, Operation Barkhane. It hosts a U.S. intelligence hub for surveillance flights across this whole region. And for 27 years have been governed by a fellow named Blaise Compaoré, who seized power back in 1986 through a coup, but subsequently has been elected, and over the years, to be quite fair to him, has mellowed and actually done some quite interesting things in development. Unfortunately, things weren't moving fast enough for many, especially the urban youth, and a protest against a possible another term for him escalated very, very quickly, and the international community kind of piled in and pushed the man out. And since then, since he left the country has had gone through at least three military officers all claiming to be president, a couple of civilian politicians showing up at radio stations and proclaiming themselves president, and the country is now facing the African Union's given them 2 weeks to get their act in order and proceed constitutionally with filling the vacancy, or else they'll be subject to sanction. But what's really affected is the fact that if this country falls under sanction, which it could well be in a military takeover, then we have to cut, under U.S. law, cut military ties to them, and it's a country that's really critical to preventing the spread of Islamist terrorism and other instability in a very critical region.
And I understand that the administration, Obama administration, has been reluctant to describe what's happened to date, which you've just laid out pretty blatantly is a coup, or perhaps even series of coups, as a coup, lest they have to, as you say, Peter Pham, and cut things off in terms of our strategic relations. Where do we think this is likely to go in terms of U.S. policy?
I think U.S. policy is a little bit of a muddle. A week ago, the U.S., I think, in a bit of not caring about the consequences and not really thinking it through, helped push out a leader who, whatever his defects, had made progress in recent years and was a critical ally and actually a mediator. He's mediated half a dozen peace agreements that kept the peace in the region. We pushed him out because we were enchanted with the youth in the streets, and I think they're looking for another Arab Spring in sub-Saharan Africa. They're reluctant to call it a coup because obviously the consequences that come from that.
We will be following it closely, as will you, Dr. Peter Pham, at the Atlantic Council's Africa program. We're very appreciative of your expertise on these matters and look forward to your updates. We'll talk with you again soon, I hope. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.